Welcome to a special podcast from WQXR. I'm Graham Parker, the Vice President of WQXR. It once meant Tchaikovsky, Sousa, and Doc Severinsen. Today it also spans video game scores, Cuban mambo bands, and the Lord of the Rings Symphony. Yes, it's high season for pops concerts. And at a time when orchestras are facing deficits, bankruptcies, and closings, pops are being taken a lot more seriously. The Philadelphia Orchestra recently announced plans to present a more light classics and film scores after it filed for bankruptcy in May. The Dallas Symphony introduced an all-pops format to its summer concert series last year. Close at home, the New York Philharmonic has staged annual concerts of Broadway hits and even cancelled its summer pops concerts in favor of an Andrea Bocelli show in September, although it claims to not actually do pops concerts. So are pops going to help struggling orchestras? Joining me are three guests today. On the line from Boston is Keith Lockhart, music director of the Boston Pops. Here in the studio is Steve Linda, a senior vice president at IMG Artists, and also on the line from San Francisco is the classical music critic of the Washington Post, Anne Majette. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anne, I want to start with you. Many orchestras are at a crossroads this season. Two-thirds are reporting deficits. So why do you think orchestras like the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Dallas Symphony are looking to do more pops concerts?
Well, I think it depends what you mean by pops concerts. I think there are different kinds of pops concerts. The sort of traditional, and of course Keith can speak to this far more expertly than I, the traditional sort of format of the summertime classics of lighter classical music, which used to be a part of the regular subscription diet and was increasingly relegated to pops concerts after the rise of pops concerts. That's one side of it that's meant to appeal to a more traditional orchestra audience. But what you're seeing, I think, is a big push in the kind of video game symphony, Lord of the Rings symphony film score, which is definitely reaching to that ever elusive younger audience. The question to me is how well the conventional pops, like the summertime classics, how well they are actually doing at reaching new audiences. I read an article a year ago, and I'm searching my brain to see where it was, that pops concerts were being seen as being in decline, as well as classical concerts, that there were groups of fans of the traditional pops concerts that were banding together to try to rally support for what they felt was a dying area, which is, of course, an irony since the pops concert, I believe, was originally founded to help broaden the appeal of orchestras.
Keith, can you actually, before we go on to just talking a little bit more about the format of pops concerts and kind of what's happening to audiences, Keith, I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of perspective. When people say pops concerts, what do you think they mean, and perhaps what do they mean? Well, what do they mean when people used to use that expression or use it now, but maybe historically? And what do you think it means now going forward?
Well, it's been a fascinating change over the course of my now 17 years at the Boston Pops, and I think it speaks volumes about the elusiveness of the current audience, where we find them, and who exactly we're looking for. When I came to Boston in 1995, we were selling, 8 or 9 weeks of 6 concerts a week in our spring pops season. That's an awful lot of product in a very short period of time. And basically selling it with no marketing whatsoever. We basically said, the Boston Pops is playing. No matter what we're playing, you're going to enjoy it. And this was good enough to guarantee an over 90% house capacity for that period of time.
And what kind of repertoire was that? Maybe you can dig into that a little.
Well,
what repertoire?
It's very much the Boston Pops concert as envisioned by Arthur Fiedler was very much a variety show sort of concept. Like classics, whether that was Strauss waltzes or Zampa overture or that sort of thing, usually a concerto of the accessible variety, a Mozart piano concerto, a Mendelssohn violin concerto, in the middle third, and only the final third of this concert went into the realm of what we would consider popular music played by orchestra, transcriptions of popular hits, Broadway music, the like. Added to that over the course of the 13 years of my illustrious predecessor, John Williams, was a good dose of film music, mostly John's film music, but of course that's an incredible catalog in itself. And we were pretty much performing that sort of a mix. Very few of these concerts were identified as individually or, you know, what exactly you're going to get in this. And what we've noticed over the course of this last decade or decade and a half is a separation of the audience into niche markets, an audience who wants to come only to Broadway concerts, a audience that wants to come to kind of a world music sort of thing or something a little bit more contemporary. And what seems to be falling through the cracks is this idea of the one-size-fits-all pops concert.
Got it. Steve, actually, before we went on mic, you were interesting and raised a question about the use of the word pops and kind of what it means to different people. Before you were at IMG, you programmed the Hollywood Bowl, a very famous venue for a really wide variety of kind of what one could call pops concerts. So when you hear the word pops concerts, what does it mean to you now? What did it mean to you then?
Well, I think Keith pointed it out quite well. You know, the original idea of the word pops was created by Arthur Fiedler, and it had that connotation of light classics. And I think if you look at what's happening in pops today, or crossover music, or as when I was at the Hollywood Bowl, we used to call the pops concerts weekend spectaculars, because, again, it was the breadth of music that was being presented was everything from pop music to alternative music to film music to traditional pops music, lighter classics, to Broadway. And really, it was about building trust with the core audience that came to those concerts.
So, Anne, I wanted to swing this back to the audience for a second. And there was a really excellent article by Susan Elliott in a recent edition of Symphony Magazine, and she pointed out a number of myths about pops concerts. I want to just highlight a couple of them. Number one myth is that they build audience for core classical, which actually is not true. And the second big myth is they reach younger audiences. And as I said, neither is the case. Can you comment on that and give us any thoughts as to why you think that might be?
You're asking me?
I am.
I think as far as building younger audiences or reaching younger audiences, I think that I addressed that a little bit at the beginning. I think that the video game concerts may reach younger audiences. I mean, I think that a traditional pops concert, what Keith called the one-size-fits-all sort of light classics approach, suffers from just the same problem as core orchestral repertory for your average 18-year-old audience member, that it's still a group of people sitting up on stage playing acoustic instruments in suits, white jackets instead of black jackets, but that distinction may be lost on a younger person to whom this whole format is not very appealing, and the problem of format is going to extend as much to pop as to core classical concerts.
But how about if that audience, though, was, because I think 18, you're right, that's one extreme, but I think a lot of traditional classical audiences are kind of 45 to 55, and there is a lot of data that says the pops audience is actually like 55 to 65. So again, we're not talking about just 18-year-olds, we're talking about a real kind of chunk of the middle of the audience here.
Sure, sure. And I would say that, you know, to my demographic, the 45-year-olds, that the image of the pops concert, probably unfairly, is not an appealing image. At least with core classical, you can feel like you're bettering your mind. But the idea, I mean, I'm not trying to diss a pops concert, I'm just trying to say that the idea of going to hear classics light, to most of my college roommates who I have trouble dragging to a classical concert of core classical, there's nothing, you know, you're not getting extra bang for your buck or virtue out of going there. And it's not a tradition that they're familiar with. It's not that it's music that they grew up with the same way that, you know, people 20 years older than us possibly did.
Keith, I wonder if you want to respond to Anne. I mean, you have the...
I would think you would. I'm totally dissing your field. Sorry.
I mean, the good looks of Keith Lockhart is used everywhere where the Boston Symphony is. The Boston Symphony is probably the country's most celebrated pops orchestra, used in national celebrations in all sorts of, you know, kind of very patriotic ways. Keith, how would you respond to Anne's kind of dissing of your...
Well, I don't, you know, actually... Surprisingly enough, I don't really take it as a dissing of the genre. I've always had kind of a strange relationship with the pops. I didn't set out to turn into a pops conductor. It kind of came across my plate, and I am really a very firm believer in breaking down those barriers, bringing audiences to music that they might not find on their own, and opening the door wide to different kinds of musical expression and musical influence in the context of the same concert, which is kind of the definition of crossover, I suppose. But Anne is absolutely right. The reason that the average pops audience in the country is indeed probably slightly older than the average classical audience is that there is always a small core of people who look for the rewards of the aesthetic rewards, the good for your soul rewards of a classical concert. But we really have not succeeded in changing the format of what exactly these crossover concerts are. So they are viewed largely as classics light. And she's right, it's hard to sell that to a new upcoming younger audience, especially if that younger audience is not immersed in any way in classical music. What we find in our course of our seasons, we don't have this comfort of a subscription base. We do all of our concerts in a very short period of time, and most people come once or maybe twice. They don't come eight times during the year, which of course presents, we have to put a lot more different people in those seats over the course of that time. But what we find when we do make efforts to reach an overtly younger audience, some like the goth, the goth cabaret artist Amanda Palmer of Dresden Dolls appearing with us. It was a spectacular concert, very successful artistically, and we sold the concert out, basically, with a lot of people, you know, with orange mohawks and the kind of people we just don't normally see in the core Pops audience. The problem, of course, is does this create a listening habit for the Pops? No, it probably creates a listening habit for Amanda Palmer. But what we find is that we're trying very hard to reach audiences that grow increasingly disparate in their needs and what they're looking for in their entertainment.
Steve, I mean, your role as a manager, and you also were a programmer before, is to kind of come up with these attractions or artists, acts to fill these kind of Pops series, sell these attractions to presenters. What trends are you seeing? I mean, maybe picking up on what Keith and Anne have said, what trends are you seeing that IMG is responding to in terms of where you're signing on new artists and what type of artists you're signing on?
Well, I think it goes back to my comment earlier, and Keith referenced it, and Anne referenced it too, and it's that crossover and niche marketing. I mean, you see that in virtually any industry, the idea of reaching out, creating events that are going to appeal to various segments of the market. You go back to, you know, way at the beginning, you know, sort of the original crossover artist James Galway, who was one of the first people to really take what was, a traditional classical format and make it a little more entertaining and a little more crossover, and is now working with people like Bill Whalen, who created the music from Riverdance, and they're creating a new concerto next year. The film and orchestra world, I think, is one of the largest areas of expansion in the Pops format. And what we've seen is John Goberman, who's the producer of Live from Lincoln Center, really sort of started this project, many years ago. It was back in 1987, my second day of work at the LA Philharmonic, when the light bulb in my head went off and I saw Alexander Nevsky, which was, you know, music by Prokofiev and a film by Sergei Eisenstein. And this was the first time I had sort of seen anything like that, where you have an orchestra, for all intents and purposes, creating a reverse live scoring session, where you're, instead of scoring something to picture, you're actually playing the music that was originally scored to the picture and matching it exactly. And you see much more of that in the video games world. You see that Bugs Bunny at Symphony has been around for 21 years. It continues to chug along, and in an incredibly entertaining and popular way, which also, one of the interesting things about this audience demographic aspect of things is when that particular concert started 20 years ago, it was really designed to reach people in their, at that point, 20s and 30s, who had grown up with Bugs Bunny cartoons. Now, 20 years later, they're in their 40s and 50s, and they're coming back and bringing their kids and introducing. It's this sort of evergreen aspect. But that crossover aspect, one of the examples you asked about artists and things we're working on, we've created a new project that's premiering at the Hollywood Bowl next month, and it's Bernstein's score to West Side Story, the entire film complete. MGM has given us permission to do it. There were no separations. We had to go back in and pull out the original orchestra, recreate all the music. And now what you're seeing, and I give the audience credit for this, there are still a lot of clip shows out there, which are, you know, clips from films with orchestra. But the audience is smarter, and the audience wants something more substantive. And what we've seen in that world is a trend away from clip shows to now full film evenings. Lord of the Rings is a perfect example. Casablanca is premiering. That's one of John's shows in Seattle in July. He did Psycho last year. They want meat. They're smart. They want to be entertained, but they want something substantive. And I think that's a real fundamental difference in change. It's not just about having fun. Yes, in many cases it's fun when you put a pop band in front of an orchestra. but they want something substantive. They want to learn something. They want to feel something like anybody does in any live concert.
Before we move on and kind of to stay with the video game, I just wanted to pause for a moment and just go down a little path, see where you guys want to go with this, and just talk about some stars of the pop's world that get a lot of play. Maybe I always think they got their start on PBS. I think of the PBS artists, Andrea Bocelli, Andre Rieu, the newest one, Jackie Evancho. I know actually Jackie is represented by IMG.
Yes.
I wonder what people's thoughts are on this. Keith, I'm actually going to start with you. What are your thoughts on these artists, and perhaps what are they doing to your business, the pop's business, and maybe what are they doing to the classical music business in the widest form possible?
Well, what we're seeing, I think, in these people with Bocelli and Charlotte Church and people like that a little bit earlier, is we're seeing a trend toward kind of the spectacle, kind of the arena-filling, one-shot deal sort of thing. And the pops really hasn't gotten on that bandwagon for a couple of reasons. One of them is that we still believe that the reason that this brand has stayed strong for 126 years now is that the pops has remained at the centerpiece of the show. And if we turn ourselves into a backing band where the difference in the size of the print on the marquee is, you know, 10 times, we're appearing behind Andrea Bocelli, for instance, it does not do our brand ultimately any good and does not create a core market for what it is that we do. It may create a core market for what Andrea Bocelli does. And the other one is simply a matter of economics, and this is one of the things that, as Steve knows, that we have going on that's different than what happens at the Hollywood Bowl, and that is that we do 5-6 concerts a week in a house that seats slightly over 2,000 people. And at the cost per appearance of some of the people you've just mentioned, it is impossible to do that and be at all economically reasonable without heavy underwriting of each of these concerts, which is not what the Boston Pops exists for in the framework of the Boston Symphony. So we take a pass on a number of things that the Hollywood Bowl does because they can have 20,000 people hearing the same thing, which of course makes much more economic sense.
And I wonder if I could ask you, I know you're very vocal, excuse the pun, in your writing about singers. There's the pun. And I wanted to just ask you to comment on Bocelli, Charlotte Church, Jackie Evancho. Anything worries you there? Anything you're excited about when you see these kinds of artists?
What I'm excited about when I see Bocelli is the door.
About some of the newer ones? I mean, Jackie Evancho, she's 10, I think. I mean, I don't know if you've heard her sing yet.
Well,
but any thoughts there?
I know who she is. I think that this actually, I mean, rather than being a trend, certainly, I mean, all the singers you're mentioning are a trend that grew out of the three tenors, basically, which was this idea that this particular kind of sort of classically trained sound could be a blockbuster, and there have been different permutations on it, but Bocelli is very much in the train of the three tenors, and Il Divo, and Josh Groban, and various like that. But I think that both Keith and Steve have been addressing the idea of the spectacle aspect. Steve said before that people want more substance. I think that particularly the rise of these, you know, big megastars addresses more that people want novelty. I mean, I suppose Andrea Bocelli is not novelty, but there's a seal of approval that he's a big star, and we know he's a big star, the Paul Pottses of the world. People are looking for something that's an event. And this is a two-edged sword, and it goes into something Keith was saying about trying to build an audience that wants to come back and back. I think that orchestras across the board, in core repertory and in pops, are, you know, hope to build an audience of people that want to come to what the orchestra is. And at the same time, there's been an emphasis on make every concert feel special. And making every concert feel special is a great way to fill a one-time arena full of people. But people are not going to come every Thursday night to hear something special. And the conundrum that I think is facing everybody is how to build an audience of people that feels that they want to come back and back and have this in their lives, rather than people who go to see something really special and then are sated for 6 months, because how many really special things can you see, especially with ticket prices that are in many orchestras considerable for people. And
is absolutely right on this point. I spent 11 years as music director of the Utah Symphony as well.
Right.
And with the constant argument with marketing was they would look at the Beethoven 9 or the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto concert that sold out and say, well, do those all year.
Right.
I was like, and with what? Should we just repeat them?
Well, Keith, I guess you, Steve, before you jump in, Keith, I want to just circle back to you for a sec. You had some clear comments about Bocelli, and I just want to say, as I said in my introduction, the New York Philharmonic has canceled its Summer Parks concerts this season and is replacing them with a single Great Lawn in Central Park event on September 15th with Andrea Bocelli. Any comments on that?
Well, I'm
in terms
I'm
of the backup
hear,
band.
I'm
in terms
sorry
of the
to hear
band?
That for one thing, because I had the great pleasure and honor of doing those concerts with New York Phil in 97.
I remember.
Yes. And, you know, and though they were certainly popular concerts, the material was real and the kind of thing that we love to present to our audience. So there was a complete Appalachian Spring and West Side Story Symphonic Dances on that concert. And that was par for the course. That's, to me, the great thing about the Concerts in the Parks series in the New York Philharmonic is the amount of outreach and the number of places they played besides Central Park during the time. And to me, you know, it's going for the one-off spectacle sort of thing. And what we need to do as an industry, and this is not just a pop-specific thing, is we need to sell the joy, the wonderment, the visceral energy of the live performing experience week in, week out. You can't do that by just shooting for the moon once. I mean, economically, the model doesn't work. And in terms of creating audience loyalty and audience expectation, it doesn't work either.
Steve, I you know, see on the IMG roster that you guys represent Jackie Evancho. As I say, you know, 10 years old, from what I can tell in the last 6 months, has just blossomed into this kind of enormous sensation. Seen her on PBS. She's one of those pledge kind of programs you see constantly. I mean, signing a 10-year-old, some might question her vocal abilities or her vocal sustainability. Can she do this for another 10 years? But what are you guys thinking when you sign an artist like that?
Well, we're thinking two things. Number one, I think, just to step back 1 second, I think there's a room for both. There's a room for both the concert that celebrates the orchestra and the concert that celebrates the artist and supports the orchestra. And I think this is a case where we're celebrating the artist, Jackie, who clearly has a following. You just can't deny it. So we had an opportunity and we took it. We don't know what's going to happen as her voice changes and as she matures. She's a delightful child. She is an interesting voice. She's controversial in some circles. But she is incredibly popular, and in a way, she's helping. I give an example of she's performing with the Atlanta Symphony, one of the 6 or 7 concerts she's doing this summer. They're having an incredible success with it, and it's building their relationship with their local PBS station. So there is a commerce aspect of these kinds of concerts without losing track of the orchestra, because I think that's absolutely critical. And in many cases, And I did this at the Bowl, and I do this when I create these concerts that we do with orchestras all over the country. The thing that's very important to me is not to lose perspective of the orchestra, because if it becomes Orchestra X or generic orchestra or nameless orchestra, I think it does a disservice to the orchestra world. So we are very intent on creating new projects specifically with orchestras in mind.
Anne, you wanted to jump in?
Can I just jump in there? Because you said before you were talking about West Side Story with live orchestra, and you were saying that people are looking for something more substantial and that the audience is smart. I would add that I do think that one feature that we see a lot with Pops concerts of all kinds is this idea that somehow playing with a live orchestra confers legitimacy or this extra oomph. When Sting appears with a live orchestra, Michael Jackson is played by live orchestra. The idea that somehow West Side Story is improved by having a live orchestra play with it represents a sort of token, I mean, a thing that creeps into a lot of Pops concert programming of this type, this idea that the orchestra is fairly interchangeable. I mean, those video games, live concerts go all over America, and it's different orchestras slotting in to the basic program, and the orchestra goes along with it because the financial benefits are considerable. But that misconception of the role of an orchestra and the sort of automatic quality of an orchestra without really deepening the understanding of an orchestra is one of the challenges of that particular vein of pop programming.
Well, on the West Side Story front, I think that's an interesting crossover case, because I think when I've had conversations with orchestras around the country, it's premiering with the LA Philharmonic. Chicago Symphony is going to be doing it in November. We're doing it at Albert Hall next June. There will be an announcement next Tuesday of another orchestra who shall be remain nameless for the moment that will be quite an interesting addition to the mix. I think there's a perfect example of Bernstein's music, which has a very specific place in the concert hall, that played live crosses over from the core audience to an audience that loves this film, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. I think there's so many examples of different approaches to it that they're all legitimate. I sound like I'm Switzerland. That yes, what you don't want to do is lose perspective of the orchestra. And there are orchestras like Boston Pops, like LA Philharmonic, like Chicago Symphony, all over the place that are creating new projects that are really focused on the orchestra, that are celebrating the orchestra. And then there are big pop stars who are out there working with orchestras. And whether they have a direct connection to the orchestra when they're playing is really up to the artist. Some really understand what it is, and Keith knows this probably better than anybody.
It's not even just what they say.
Two versions of the same statement.
It's also the depth of their own musical understanding, what they bring to the table, and whether they're interested in a genuine collaboration or just interested in another outlet, basically.
Right.
So we work with people like Elvis Costello, Ben Folds, come to mind, who are such intelligent musicians that they really... they're excited by the timbral possibilities of working with an orchestra. It's not just another gig for them. It really truly is a collaboration. And those are the people we try to seek out, because I stick to the outside of, you know, a quick jump on people's meters of knowing that you're there. I'm not sure that what working with the other artist does for you in the long run.
I just want to pivot just to one thing. And you mentioned this actually also at the opening, Keith, about the kind of where the pops concept started, Arthur Fiedler model, Strauss waltzes, Rossini overtures, Wagner preludes, patriotic marches, etc. This now seems to be kind of blended with a traditional classical subscription audience. Is anyone doing that really traditional model anymore, or have now we just given it up and just been like merging these two things together? Pines of Rome is just a subscription staple now, but yet it used to be a pop staple.
Well, Summertime Classics, the New York Philharmonic does that. And Henry Fogel, in an earlier excellent article in Symphony Magazine, pointed out that all of these things used to be real components of the subscription concert, and that a subscription concert was a much more varied and often lighthearted affair, and that with the advent of pops concerts, the model for subscription concerts became more sober and less fun. And I thought that was an interesting point that we don't think about.
Basically, the advent of, in many cases, I mean, you know, Boston's a little different. We've had this separated brand for over a century and a quarter now, but
right.
In a lot of cases, it really meant the ghettoizing of kind of popular symphonic repertoire.
And I, as a critic, have realized that I've been guilty of that. I'll be very, you know, oh, this concert was awfully light. And, you know, in a regular subscription diet where people are going every week, yes, you want some light along with the heavy. You don't want every week to be artistically challenging in the same way.
You look back at the subscription programs of Reiner in Chicago, for instance. He did things like Carousel Waltz on subscription concerts. Great music, but now people would look askance at you if any orchestra as august as the Chicago Symphony chose to program that in the realm of a normal, everyday, weekend classical subscription concert.
Absolutely, but ironically, orchestras are more and more looking at the kind of crossover project you mentioned before with a younger generation of artists. A lot of these new composers coming up, I think of Chicago with Mason Bates and Anna Klein, where with Mason Bates, who's a composer who is also a DJ and crosses fairly fluently, that's reaching into a different kind of music, but through a sort of artistically sanctioned or critically sanctioned doorway. Similarly, you look at projects with Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood and Sufjan Stevens' BQE project. Those are, you know, established indie rock stars who
Nick
are doing...
Nick Neely as well, and actually Johnny Greenwood is the principal, the composer in residence of the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is my other hat. I think it begs the question of, you know, if we look at what the future of pops is, if we look at the broadening of the attempt to broaden the tent of what of the core product of these orchestras, we wonder whether there are going to be in 20 years separate pop series on these concerts, or whether all of the concerts are going to contain lighter elements, or the series are going to contain lighter elements within them. In other words, the two will be kind of assimilated back together again. What we've found in Boston over the years is, I mean, I've done Afternoon of a Faun, I've done the Danse Sacrale from Rite of Spring, I've done premieres of new pieces by people like Christopher Rouse on Pops concerts. It's not so much the repertoire. I wouldn't suggest, you know, Moses and Aaron in concert on a Pops series concert, but it's how it is presented. It's breaking down the barriers. It's having musicians and performers, soloist performers and conductors who are willing and able and good at talking to the audience, not just to be talking heads, but to engage them in the product, to make them feel welcome, to make them feel part of the event that is going on. That's one of the things that bothers me. As I think we stand or fall in these next few years in the entire orchestra industry on how well we sell the excitement of the live concert experience, and that has to involve something other than this, you know, this fourth wall that has been built up between the traditional way of an orchestra performing a concert and the audience's passive reception of it.
Anne, how about your thoughts on these?
I strongly agree with what Keith says, and I think we're seeing that. I mean, the approach Maren Alsop is taking in Baltimore, for example, where she talks a lot to the audience. She's playing with the concert format, and she's doing a lot of work herself in what used to be the Pops concert, which was, you know, given traditionally to another conductor. I think that, you know, Steve has mentioned too, and Keith, that the whole orchestra field is trying to do the same thing in terms of broadening, reaching new audiences. So I'm not sure so much what specifically I'd say one side of it should learn from another, except that I think orchestras would do well not to be, and orchestras and critics, I must include myself, would do well not to be so holier than thou about the artistic sanctity of their offerings, which is an attitude that turns off new audiences very rapidly.
Steve?
I think the idea of being all things to all people or one thing to all people needs to be merged. I think the idea of hearing, when you listen to films, unless you're listening into it in surround sound, in most cases people are listening to it on DVD, and the soundtrack and the score is dialed down. You don't hear it. So here's an opportunity to hear some of the greatest composers in the world, from, you know, Bernstein to John Williams and all, you know, walks of life in the film music world, to hear their music live with an orchestra, and to realize that this may be, whether it translates to somebody going, you know, to a core classical concert or not, it may be the first time that a young person or even a middle-aged person has heard the orchestra for the first time.
Anne, how about you?
I suppose, idealistically, I'd like to say that Pops concerts should not underestimate their audience. So that's easy for me to say as a critic, because I don't have to sell tickets. But the idea that Pops, you know, is for a more easily pleased audience, a less discriminating audience, you know, Keith was talking about the range of repertoire he's programmed, and I would like to see that continue.
And how about Keith, wrapping it up?
Well, I'd say the two things that in my own mind and heart I'd like to have all of us keep in mind is, one of them is that as we deal with a population which grows, I think, increasingly less exposed to symphonic music year by year, by dint of loss of music education programs, loss of participatory activities, every concert we do, not just Pops concerts, not just Peter and the Wolf for seven-year-olds, is an outreach concert. Every product that we present has to be thought of, including the most serious core classical concerts, as reaching some people who really are not clearly in our fold. And if we can look at the world like that, then I think we will know how to reach the right audiences and what to give them when they come here.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining us. This has been a special podcast from WQXR Radio, looking at the state of the Pops concert. My guests have been Keith Lockhart, music director of the Boston Pops, Steve Linda, vice president of attractions with IMG Artists, and Anne Majette, the classical music critic of the Washington Post. The podcast producer is Brian Wise, and our engineer is Bill O'Neill. I'm Graham Parker, the vice president of WQXR. Thank you for listening.